Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Claire Clark, one of the hosts of the channel, and today we're talking to Martin Summers, a professor of history at Boston College and the author of Madness in the City of Magnificent Intentions, a history of race and mental illness in the nation's capital, which was published in 2019 by Oxford University Press. Martin, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Claire. Thank you for inviting me. Happy to be here.
I wonder if you could begin our interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, sure. Well, as you mentioned, I am a professor of history and African diaspora studies at Boston College. I have been in the academy for a little over 20 years, actually probably closer to 25 years now. I received my PhD at Rutgers University in 1997, and I was actually trained as a cultural historian of the African-American experience, and I had particular interests in gender and sexuality kind of late 19th and early 20th century. I worked with David Levering Lewis, who is a Pulitzer Prize winning historian. He's the biographer of W.B. Du Bois, as well as author of a number of other books on African-American history, and Deborah Gray White, who is probably one of the preeminent historians of African-American women's history. Her book, Aren't I a Woman, about female slaves in the antebellum South, published in 1985, is really one of the classic works. So I was really fortunate to work with both of them. They were essentially co-advisors as I worked on my dissertation, and certainly continued to give me both academic and professional advice, or I should say been intellectual sounding boards for me since my years in graduate school.
And how did you come to write Madness in the City of Magnificent Intentions? Because it in the beginning of the book, in the acknowledgments, I think you say this was not the book that you you set out to write.
Right. Yeah, well, I actually pretty much stumbled into the book. As I said, I was really interested in gender and sexuality in African-American history around the turn of the 20th century. And so my dissertation was on Black middle-class masculinity in the early 20th century. And I subsequently revised that and published it as a book in 2004. And I was searching for a second project, and I still wanted to write something about Black masculinity, but I decided that I was going to focus on African-American men's kind of relationship to the state by really looking at how African-American men in a number of different kinds of institutions experience their masculinity and subsequently attempted to construct a gendered sense of self. And so the institutions that I was interested in looking at were the prison, the military, the school, and the hospital. And I thought that Washington, D.C. would be a real ideal place because of the presence of the U.S. Penitentiary, Howard University, which was a college that was founded after the Civil War to educate freed people, Freedmen's Hospital, which again was a hospital founded after the Civil War to provide care for freed people, and subsequently became the teaching hospital for Howard University's medical school. And of course, there's a significant military presence in Washington, D.C. And so in the summer of 2001, I began the research by going to the National Archives. And I began looking at the Freedmen's Bureau records. And I actually grew up in the Washington, D.C. area. And so I was aware of St. Elizabeth's Hospital. And I noticed that there was a record group of St. Elizabeth's records at the National Archives. Mm-hmm. So it was towards the end of my research trip, I just decided to begin poking around in those records. And the first thing that I looked at was the register book, which, as you imagine, was this incredibly large bound volume dating back to 1855. That was the first year that the hospital was open. And the spine's deteriorating, the corners of the pages are fraying. And I just decided to start. I noticed that the hospital was admitting Black patients. And so I just started building a database of patients there, again, thinking that it was just going to be part of this larger history about Black masculinity in the state. And then I came across the entry of one patient who was admitted in 1866, and I talk a little bit about her in the book at the beginning of chapter two. And she was admitted with a diagnosis of mania, and in the register book, there's also a column for the supposed cause. The clerk wrote in the column the blackness of her husband, and I had no idea what that meant, but it really stuck with me, and I left the National Archives that summer and just decided to start reading the scholarship on the history of psychiatry in the United States. And it became very clear to me early on that there weren't very many books that or histories that use race as a category of historical analysis. So I just decided that at that point, this was a huge gap in the scholarship. Mm-hmm. And I decided that I would just go ahead and write a history of St. Elizabeth's and its relationship to Washington, D.C.'s African-American community as a way of getting at these larger questions about the role that ideas about racial difference have played in the development of psychiatry as a profession.
Well, the book definitely does that, and it does that well. I think it's destined for classic status.
There's also one quick thing too. I forgot to mention. There's actually a real irony here too, is that I went to Rutgers University, and I actually took class with Gerald Grob, who was the foremost historian of psychiatry. But at the time when I was at graduate school, I had no interest in the history of medicine or the history of psychiatry. And so I only later, restarted our relationship, I guess, after I had begun work on this book and seeing him at conferences. And so it's quite interesting that, again, I studied with him, but I would later go on to actually write in a field that he essentially was almost single-handedly responsible for developing.
That's funny. That's quite a coincidence, or I don't know what we would call it. I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about St. Elizabeth's Hospital. In the history of psychiatry, I see there, in my view, there's often a kind of tension in the books about whether the history of a given institution, asylum, or sanitarium or whatever, can stand in for the history of psychiatry. Mm-hmm. itself as a whole. Mm-hmm. And so I wondered if you could talk about St. Elizabeth's and why it's a significant institution.
Yeah. So, as I mentioned, it's significant for a number of reasons. One is it's one of the only, or it's one of two, I should say, federal asylums in the country for, you know, the 19th century and much of the 20th century. Actually, it was the only federal asylum in the country in the 19th century, and was joined by the Canton Asylum in South Dakota for quote-unquote insane Indians in the early part of the 20th century. And as a result, it did get actually quite there was a significant investment of resources in the institution, although, you know, like most asylums, it suffered from kind of chronic overcrowding. But from its very earliest, from its very founding, I should say, it admitted Black patients, right? The initial mandate of the hospital was to house and rehabilitate people who were under federal jurisdiction or in federal custody. And for the most part, that meant sailors and soldiers who had become insane, as well as U.S. residents in territories who didn't have any state citizenship. But because it was situated in the District of Columbia and Washington, D.C. did not have a county asylum, again, from its very beginnings, its officials admitted a residence, civilian residents of Washington, D.C., those who were too poor to afford private treatment, and the significant Black population in Washington, D.C. So from, again, its very beginnings, it admitted African-American patients. And so it's one of the few asylums, in particular, especially in the South, that did so. And even the two other asylums in the South, the numbers of Black patients didn't approach the percentage of Black patients as a total population in St. Elizabeth's. And so St. Elizabeth's always had a very racially diverse population. So for me, that really provided an opportunity to look at how, again, ideas of racial difference actually shaped the way that psychiatrists thought about insanity, thought about mental health, and then subsequently, treated their Black patients. I think the other thing that makes it significant, and again, the racially diverse patient population is relevant here, is that there was St. Elizabeth's in many ways was on the cutting edge of the production of psychiatric knowledge, mm-hmm. As well as therapeutics, right? So it was one of the first hospitals to employ hydrotherapy, and it did so in the late 19th century. Its superintendent in the first 30 years of the 20th century, William Allenson White, was one of kind of the foremost promoters of psychoanalysis in the American psychiatric profession, and he actually introduced psychotherapy into St. Elizabeth's. The popularizer of the lobotomy, William Freeman, worked mm-hmm. at St. Elizabeth's in the 1930s, although William Allenson White was opposed to the use of lobotomy, and so I don't think that he did any of his lobotomies at St. Elizabeth's. He did most of them in private practice or at other asylums. So one of the things that I think, and then this gets to the other question about, does St. Elizabeth stand in, or how does it stand in for the history of psychiatry as a whole? I think one of the things that's really interesting about the history of psychiatry is that race has always been a really kind of enigmatic variable when psychiatrists kind of think about, what is mental illness, what is mental health, are there particular groups that are prone or susceptible to mental illness to begin with, or particular types of mental illness, particular manifestations of mental illness. And so a lot of these questions were being worked out. The answers were being sought after in St. Elizabeth's, and it was precisely the presence of this large Black patient population that allowed them to kind of do some of this work. Although at the end of the day, they were no closer to kind of finding or being able to explain actually what role race or racial difference played in the etiology or the manifestation of mental illness.
Let's talk a little bit about St. Elizabeth's roots. Its founding and its operation in the era of what's often called moral treatment. You detail how this founding is related essentially to kind of a racist medical science, and the production of knowledge, psychiatric research and knowledge. Could you tell us a little bit about what St. Elizabeth's looked like when it was founded? Why would patients seek admission there? Why would Black patients seek admission there? And then what kind of research was being produced?
Yeah, so it was founded in the mid-19th century. So 1855 was the year that it opened. And that's actually only 11 years after the founding of the Association for the, I can never remember, AmPsy, the first kind of psychiatric profession, which was founded in 1844. And the principal therapeutic regime at that time was moral treatment, right? And so the idea was that the best way to cure the mentally ill was to remove them from the source of their psychical distress and place them in a very tranquil kind of idyllic environment where you could really regulate their behavior, make sure they got enough sleep, they had a nutritious diet, they weren't idle, so they were employed in certain ways, and that they also be situated, that the asylum be situated in a very healthy environment, one that was not exposed to fevers, right? So in Washington D.C., for instance, it's a very especially in the 19th century, low-lying areas, a very malarial environment. So it was really important to situate the hospital at a higher elevation, and so the hospital's officials were very particular about citing the location or citing the institution, and they wanted to make sure that it was in an environment where white patients, or I should say white, local white residents were not very sick, were not, that there wasn't a high incidence of fever or malaria. And you see actually this being articulated very overtly in much of the correspondence between the officials. And then, they also had to deal with this question of, how are you going to house this, again, racially diverse patient population? And so they basically created separate lodges for the quote unquote colored patients that were somewhat removed from the center building. And the way that they justified this was essentially by making the argument that it would be very stressful for white patients to occupy the same dorms, or I should say wards, as Black patients. And so the proximity to Black patients would impede white patients' recovery. And so this kind of logic of racial difference, essentially a kind of also a racist justification of segregation, was very much built into the therapeutic logic that characterized the hospital. To your question, why would Black patients want to have been admitted? So this is a really interesting one, because St. Elizabeth's actually did not, Washington, D.C. did not have a voluntary admissions law until 1948. They were actually quite late. States had begun passing voluntary admissions laws in the early 20th century, the 19-teens, first decade of the 20th century and the 19-teens, but it wasn't until 1948 that Washington, D.C. Passed a voluntary admissions law. And so most of the patients did not seek to be admitted, right? They were admitted by either their family members, right, or by the local officials, right, the Metropolitan Police, for instance, and then they had to go through a very very kind of bureaucratic process to be admitted, right? You had to have two physicians testify that they were in fact insane. You had to have two DC residents testify that the individual was incapable of self-support before they were actually admitted to the hospital. Now, again, there were some, and I write about this in the book quite extensively, there were many Black Washingtonians who did feel like St. Elizabeth's was was an institution that they could turn to actually deal with the problem that a mentally ill member of the family posed. And so it was not unusual for Black Washingtonians to try to get their loved ones admitted to the hospital, and then to also, continue to try to manage their therapeutic experience once they were in the hospital. And there are actually a handful of occasions, instances I found where some Black patients who were already in St. Elizabeth's sought to stay, even though the officials thought that they had recovered enough to be discharged. And some of the reasons that they wanted to stay was because their life outside of the institution was very precarious for them, right? They may not have had any economic opportunities, viable economic opportunities. So the fact that they actually worked in the hospital, not for any money, but that they worked in the hospital was one reason that they may have stayed, or that they actually got medical care, not for their mental illness, but for their bodily infirmities, or so these are some of the reasons that some patients may have wanted to stay, is because staying inside, having getting regular meals was better than the uncertainty of the unknown outside of the hospital.
And what was the treatment at the time? What was moral treatment for Black patients and for white patients?
So again, it's just making sure that they were in a fairly peaceful environment, and making sure that they got plenty of sleep, a nutritious diet. Also, when it came to there needed to also be a fairly a good balance, I should say, between labor and leisure, and so But labor meant different things for Black patients and white patients, right? So, so for Black patients, labor meant working in menial jobs that kept the hospital functioning. So Black women worked primarily in the hospital's laundries. Black men worked primarily at kind of clearing the fields as being essentially the unskilled labor in the major kind of infrastructural projects on the hospital's campus, or working in the kitchen, and so, and these were forms of employment that would characterize Black patient life throughout the first half of the 20th century as well. And again, it was framed as labor, right? So I'm sorry, therapy. That essentially, which you, from the hospital official's perspective, what you're doing is also you're re-socializing these mentally ill individuals so that once they are in fact released, they will be able to enter into those kinds of social roles that they occupied before coming into the hospital. But in some ways, that also very much ignored the existence of class difference amongst Black Washingtonians, because not every Black Washingtonian who was admitted to St. Elizabeth's was, say, working class. And then on the flip side of that, white patients, well, white male patients, essentially engaged in farm labor, which was actually seen as something that was much, it was a much more desirable a job on at St. Elizabeth's than, say, again, working clearing fields or excavating ditches and things of that nature. And then the female patients, I hesitate to call it a form of employment, but the activities that they did were things like needlework. And so these kinds of activities that might be associated more with the tasks or the duties of middle-class homemakers.
I think therapeutic labor is the term that you use. Is that the term that the... the therapists used at the time?
They definitely use the term labor, and they framed labor as a form of therapy. Absolutely.
I'd like to talk about the types of research that were being produced. So the research initially that was being produced, I'm trying to think of a way to phrase it, put forward the theory that Black and white psyches were kind of fundamentally different. Can you tell us a little bit about that research? What were some of the assumptions that it made, and what were some of the findings that were reported?
Yeah, absolutely. And so this idea that the Black and white psyche were fundamentally different, it really goes back to the mid-19th century, before you had even any kind of comparative psychology research going on at the hospital. They weren't really pursuing research in this area until the 20th century, but the questions that they were seeking to answer through this research had existed much earlier, right? It wasn't even a question of whether or not the Black and white psyches were different. It was just, how were they different, right? What explains their difference? So there was an a priori assumption that the Black and white psyches were in fact different. And you certainly see that in the ways that these physicians in the mid-19th and up through the late 19th century were talking about Black insanity, right? Going back to this fundamental question, was it possible for Black people to become insane to begin with? And if so, then what did that insanity look like and how did it differ from white insanity? So one psychiatric consensus in the late 19th century was that Black people were more prone to mania than they were melancholia, whereas white insane were more prone to melancholia than mania. And so by the time you get to the early 20th century, so they're operating from the assumption that in fact Black and white, the Black and white psyche are fundamentally different. And again, the main question was, well, what explains that difference? And then as an ancillary question to that was, can we think about, well, there were two ancillary questions. Is there a way that we can look at, take kind of the Black psyche and particularly the Black, the damaged psyche, and will that give us any insight into how to approach the damaged white psyche, right? And so that was one. But then also, I think connected to that, another question here also was, well, is there anything in our knowledge about the Black psyche that will actually help us, if not cure, certainly care for the Black mentally ill, right? So this is one of the things that I try to do with the book is just not acknowledge that there were racist or racialist dimensions, right, to mm-hmm. the psychiatric knowledge that was produced, the impulse to pursue this comparative psychology research was in some ways animated by a fundamental belief in Black difference and also Black inferiority. But at the same time, these psychiatrists also did not completely abandon this mission of also caring for mentally ill Blacks. And so really kind of thinking about how these two really kind of coexisted in this space and the effects that it had on Black patients. So to get back to the questions, what were they finding? Well, this is the thing. I mean, in many ways, they were just rehashing many of these earlier kind of 19th century ideas about the differences between the Black and white psyche, right? Kind of Blacks are more prone to experiencing mania, and even after, say, this tripartite division of insanity between mania, melancholy, and dementia had been displaced by the introduction of the diagnostic concepts of dementia praecox, or later schizophrenia, and manic depressive disorder. The ways that the Black mental illness in the late 19th century, they were just essentially mapped onto these new diagnostic concepts. So even as, for instance, psychiatrists recognized that Blacks did suffer from manic depressive disorder, which had mm-hmm. been assumed to be a predominantly white form of mental illness, they still argued that, well, but yes, even though they do suffer from manic depressive disorder, they're more apt to be stay in the manic phase than they are in the depressive phase. And again, that's just it's the old 19th century psychiatric, it's a retread of the old 19th century psychiatric consensus. And then the last thing I'll say about this too is that what's really interesting is on more than one occasion, you even see the psychiatrists in these articles that they're writing. And this is another thing that's significant about St. Elizabeth's. It is, in fact, most of the scholarship on comparative psychology research came out of St. Elizabeth's in the 1920s and the 1930s. In some instances, these psychiatrists who were doing this research, they even acknowledge in the article itself that they have not been able to locate any evidence that blacks and whites respond to external stimuli any differently, let alone be able to explain why they do so, right? They're not even able to observe that this supposed distinction.
So the results don't really even match the theory.
Exactly.
How does the rise of dynamic psychiatry change the way mental illness is conceived and treated?
So by the time you get to the early 20th century, you have the shift in the paradigm from neurology to dynamic psychiatry, right? Of neurology, basically arguing that there's a somatic basis to mental illness, and it's also hereditary, or in many cases, it's hereditary to dynamic psychiatry's argument or framing of a mental illness as a result of maladaptation, right? So in order to lead a mentally healthy lifestyle or a mentally healthy lifestyle equates to kind of social adjustment, right? Kind of appropriate social adjustment. And then there are those who aren't able to adjust, and so they become maladapted, and that might be the result of kind of psychosexual conflict or interpersonal relationships. And so one expression of dynamic psychiatry is not the sole expression of dynamic psychiatry, but one is psychoanalysis, or I should say one form of dynamic psychiatry is psychoanalysis. And many psychoanalysts believe that psychosis was the result of an individual's regression to their race's ancestral past, or a more primitive stage of the race's development. But in the early 20th century, African Americans were still thought to be primitive, right? A much more primitive than whites. And so since African Americans were presumed to be more primitive to begin with, psychiatrists were still confronted with this question of whether a black person exhibiting symptoms of psychosis was actually psychotic, right? Or were they just exhibiting the kind of normal characteristics of their primitive culture? Mm-hmm. And so again, this raises the enigmatic variable, still very much shaped the way that dynamic psychiatrists were thinking about mental illness, and then the way that played itself out in terms of therapeutics. So, what I was able to kind of establish and argue through the looking at these case files. Well, first of all, I should also say that St. Elizabeth's was a really large institution. And so the number of patients who actually received psychotherapy were fairly small, but there were some black patients who did receive psychotherapy. And of course there were white patients who received psychotherapy. But one of the things that I argued after looking at these case files was that from the psychiatrist perspective, they weren't so much interested in really, when they engaged in psychotherapy with Black patients, they weren't so much interested at getting at the root of their psychological problems, right? Kind of really delving into the Black patients' complexes in the same way that they were with white patients. And you see also this, you see this in the way that the psychiatrists talk about, not so much in their exchanges with Black patients, but in the articles they write about. And so there's this discourse about the quote unquote inaccessibility of the Black psyche. And some of this is, again, shaped by ideas about a fundamental racial difference, right? The experiences of Black people are so fundamentally different from whites that it's really impossible to fully understand the Black interiority. And then also that Blacks are kind of naturally duplicitous, right? So there, that kind of inaccessibility is compounded by Blacks kind of naturally deceptive temperaments or demeanors. And so in that sense, what I argue in the book is that psychotherapy was aimed not so much at curing, right, Black patients, but just really dealing with the surface problems, really kind of getting them to the point where they might be well enough to do work in the hospital, right? Go to the laundry, go to the kitchen. And then there's also the continued use of other forms of therapy, kind of somatic-based therapy, such as hydrotherapy mechanical restraints, right? Labor, again, was something that still formed a very significant part of the therapeutic paradigm for Black patients.
What was really...
Even after...
What was really striking to me reading the book was how you have this paradigm shift, right, from moral treatment to more dynamic psychiatry. And these are supposed to be two very different paradigms, ways of thinking about, mind and mental health. But they were equally racist,
right,
and,
right.
And then the way that they, that therapy was actually carried out with patients on a day-to-day basis didn't necessarily change that much with the grand paradigm shift either.
No, yeah, you're exactly right. And I don't actually don't think I say that. So I'm glad that you saw that, because that's the other thing too, is that you continue to see the resurfacing of these older ideas that go back to the 19th century. So again, even after the turn to psychiatric universalism after World War II, right, where psychiatrists essentially abandon the idea that there is, in fact, this fundamental difference between the Black and the white psyche, they're still talking about Black mental illness as being fundamentally different from white mental illness, right? So you have this this turn towards explaining why African Americans are disproportionately susceptible or prone to schizophrenia, which is, again, it's just a retread of Blacks are more prone to mania, right? Especially after schizophrenia becomes associated with aggressiveness and criminality. And then also in the 1950s, in the 1960s, you also have psychiatrists beginning to, again, explain surge in rates of mental illness among African Americans as a result of their becoming equal, right? As a result of the civil rights movement, and they can't quite handle integration and competing with whites on an equal playing field. And that is a reverberation of the discourse of freedom, right? Causing insanity or elevated rates of insanity among African Americans in the 1880s and the 1890s.
So we're running out of time, and I still have a couple more questions I want to make sure that we get to before we do our traditional final question. To kind of quickly bring us through the end of the book and up to the present, what you touched on a little bit, what happens to this story after World War II, and then what is the status of St. Elizabeth's today? You can just bring us up to speed to the present.
Sure. So after World War II is very interesting. As I mentioned earlier, St. Elizabeth's main mission was to house and rehabilitate soldiers and sailors. And so after World War II, basically the military stopped sending its mentally ill service members to St. Elizabeth's. And that's largely for two reasons. One was St. Elizabeth's, like many large public hospitals around the country, were starting to be seen as snake pits, right? These large facilities, kind of warehousing mentally ill people and not providing any treatment. And then the other factor that contributed to that was that the VA system begins building psychiatric hospitals, and so these soldiers and sailors are kind of redirected there. And what ends up happening is that the demographics of the hospital shift dramatically, so that it basically becomes a civilian hospital. And because it's located in Washington, D.C., which by the 1960s is a majority Black city, the hospital really becomes, the patient population becomes primarily African American, geriatric patients suffering from chronic mental illnesses. And it really becomes associated again with kind of the worst elements of a public mental hospital or a state mental hospital. It actually loses accreditation in the early 1970s before it reacquires it in the mid 1970s. And again, like other state mental institutions, it eventually went through a process of deinstitutionalization, so that now it is primarily an outpatient. It serves an outpatient population. I think that something like 99% of the patients, I probably shouldn't use that specific, very large percentage of patients at St. Elizabeth's are forensic patients. Mm-hmm. So they're either there because they've been found not guilty by reason of insanity, or they're awaiting psychiatric evaluation before they go to court. But having said that too, it's also what's really interesting to St. Elizabeth's is it's going through a bit of a renaissance as well. It has a new state-of-the-art hospital, and much of the campus is it's in Southeast D.C., which is in one of the poor communities in the District of Columbia. And so there's a lot of development that's going on. Actually, the Department of Homeland Security has moved in and has taken over the original part of the campus with the center building. I think the hope is that that the presence of DHS will generate ancillary businesses and will be economically beneficial for Anacostia, which is the the neighborhood that surrounds St. Elizabeth's.
So back to your original research question, this history of this community and the state continues.
Right.
I've got one more question before our traditional final question. And I asked if I could quote from the end of the book because it is just, it's so beautifully written and you said I could. So at the end of the book addresses the magnificent intentions in the book's title. And you write, at times these, and in particular, the intentions in regard to the misguided and often racist ideals of the institution's medical providers, but also the intentions refer to the intentions and the expectations of Black sufferers and their families. Mm-hmm. And you write, at times these intentions were in accord with those of Black sufferers and their families who ran the institution. At others, they were in conflict. In the end, the history of race and mental illness is the story of the distance between expectations and limitations, between medical altruism and racism, between medical objectification and sufferers' agency, between the aspirational and the real. What lessons might the history of St. Elizabeth's have for those of us working on advancing racial equity and justice in academic medicine today?
Thank you for reading that that quote. I think two things, and from two different perspectives. So one from health professionals, those people who are in a position to providing care for sufferers who, as you know, are at their most vulnerable when they're in these kinds of relationships with clinicians. And I think, and this is again something that runs through the book, which I've really tried to highlight. I didn't want to write a book that basically said that, you know, psychiatry is a racist project, and it's always been. I don't believe that, because I do believe that psychiatrists or physicians in general go into their line of work with a desire to heal. But often that desire to heal is really compromised by a belief in racial difference and the inferiority of Black people. And sometimes that belief is unconscious. Often it is unconscious. But how, you know, again, this desire to heal and this belief in racial difference can coexist. They do coexist, and they shape the ways that healthcare is delivered in this country. And so I would hope that, you know, this is something that we need to constantly be, be attentive to, and be on guard, against. And then from the other perspective, about black people's relationship to psychiatry and the medical profession more generally, I think we have this narrative that there is this fundamental mistrust, that Blacks have this fundamental mistrust of the medical profession and of psychiatry. And I think that's true to a certain extent, but I also think that it's much more complicated than that. I don't think that Blacks only exist in an apathetic or antagonistic relationship to the medical profession. In fact, I think that they have always sought to engage the medical profession to make sure that they are getting the care that they deserve, the same care as whites do. And so so I think that it's worth keeping that in mind as well. And it was really reinforced during the pandemic, is that we bought into this idea uncritically that Black people were vaccine hesitant. And that's true to a certain extent, but at the same time, Blacks the people would just say, well, you just go and you ask, you answer questions that Black people right. have, right? Or you also make sure that there are ways that they can access the vaccine. It's often as much about access as it is about attitudes, and so we have to, I think, on both sides, we have to have much more complicated narratives about the relationship between the physicians, the medical profession, psychiatrists, and people of color in this country.
Well, Martin, the book is a wonderful example of how to do that and how to tell those complicated stories. And I'm sure that there will be many similar books to follow by other scholars. But I've also gotten to our traditional final question, which is where I'm supposed to ask, what is next? What's next for you? What are you working on now?
Well, I've absolutely fallen in love with the history of medicine, so I'm continuing this work. And it's something that was really, it was an interest that was sparked by, as I was finishing up the St. Elizabeth's book and I was writing the last chapter on deinstitutionalization and community mental health care. And so I'm basically working on a project now that looks at how medical experts and government officials and community grassroots organizations in the second half of the 20th century thought about the relationship between urbanization and mental illness and kind of sometimes collaborated with one another and at other times kind of battled with one another over developing mental health care policies that would address the needs of low-income African Americans in urban areas. And so it's called Inner City Blues. Tentatively now it's Inner City Blues, African American Mental Health and Social Policy in 20th Century Urban America. And right now it looks at Washington, D.C., Boston, and Chicago.
Well, that sounds like a wonderful project. And I just selfishly, I hope it doesn't take 20 years because I want to read it right away.
Me too. Thank you, Claire.
Thank you so much for sharing your work with us today.
Thank you for inviting me. I had a wonderful time.